good? All right. Okay, the House Education Committee will come to order. It is Monday, December 8th at 2 o'clock. If you have a cell phone with you, please turn it to silent. Actually, please turn it off, not just to silent, because it interferes with the sound, and I do know that there are people that are listening. This is the last meeting of the House Education Committee as it's currently constituted. So thank you all for a great time of it. We do have a visitor with us today, Representative Betty Comp, who is the chair of the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means and a distinguished educator herself. And Representative Gorsuch is not able to be here with us today. He unfortunately experienced a house fire this week, so he and his family are dealing with that. He and his family and pets, everybody's okay, but that's a pretty difficult event. So if you think to send him a note, that might be a nice thing to let him know we're thinking about him. So we have a really full agenda today, as is our tradition here. We're going to start with a preview of the governor's education initiatives. We are going to go in the order that is listed here. And in order to get through everything, I've talked with Nancy and Rob and Danny. We're going to start by having them give their presentations, and we're going to hold our questions until they get through the presentations, but they've agreed to make sure we have plenty of time to ask questions because I know you all have a lot of them. So anything before we get started and open that? Great. So with that, I will open an informational meeting on the preview of the governor's 2015 education initiatives. So Nancy Golden, Rob Saxton, and Daniel Ledesma. Ledesma or Ledesma?
Ledesma.
Ledesma. Thanks. Welcome back.
Thank you.
And we have till 3 on this. Yes?
Yeah.
Yes.
Chair Galzer, co-chair Springer. For the record, I'm Nancy Golden, the chief education officer for the Oregon Education Investment Board. And with my colleagues, we're going to split this up into 3 parts. I'm going to talk a little bit about one of the key roles of the Oregon Education Investment Board, which is to think of strategic investments to really help move the needle on the achievement compacts. Danny will be talking about the governor's budget, his approach to the budget. And then Rob is going to talk more specifically about scaling up some of previous initiatives and the new one. We understand and appreciate that what you would really value is time for questions, so we'll move quickly. So I just want to talk about, with the Oregon Education Investment Board, one of our key jobs is to create a seamless system, really focus on transition, and then suggest key investments to the budget. So we work with our outcome and an investment committee. We actually started last May. So May 29th was our first public meeting as we started to think about these strategic investments that we think can make a difference for our students. So you can imagine from May 29th till now, lots of meetings, lots of extra meetings. And eventually we came up with, a one pager that can kind of show you where we landed. What we really did was, if we think of that seamless system from birth to college and career, we're thinking about 3 key pathways. So the first pathway is to kindergarten and third grade reading. And if you look up there, what you're going to see is a number of early intervention strategies that will help us get there. They're listed there. You know, I think the main idea is to really think about making sure we have stable families, making sure our families, particularly the ones who need it the most, get quality daycare, and making sure all along the way we're using culturally responsive practices. What we know is that if we work with pre-literacy skills, starting as early as birth, by the time we get to kindergarten, we can get students ready to learn. And so that's one of the key things as we move into trying to meet that third grade benchmark. So what you'll see as we move along this pathway is that we've really got to focus on that third grade reading proficiency, because we know that reading proficiently at third grade is really a gateway skill to get more students to graduate from high school, to get students to complete college. Within that area, you'll see some of the things we worked on with the Quality Network, the support for low-performing schools, the importance of a mentor for every new teacher so we can keep our new talents and the school leaders in a career that is so critical, and also knowing that the collaboration grants have shown a lot of data that shows they're really impacting student learning. A critical thing for the third grade reading, Rob will go into more detail about that, but is the idea of having summer school, after school, with community-based organizations or culturally specific organizations. We think this is a win for all children, because if you can help the children who are behind, by the time you get to the class, everybody's on track, so it's all about acceleration. It's not about remediation. I can tell you as a superintendent, I spend a lot of money on remediation from third grade all the way up to 12th grade. If we can prevent that, think of all the resources we could have to do all the programs that we all want to do. So that's a little bit about that pathway from kindergarten to third grade reading. And then the second pathway is the pathway to high school and post-secondary completion. And what we know are there's a number of strategies we believe can really help that. The first one's what we're referring to as ninth grade on track, and that's really about ensuring that in ninth grade, or before they start their first day of 10th grade, students have 6 high school credits and attendance at about the 90% level. We know that's a critical transition point because students start to believe, if I'm not on track in ninth grade, I'm not going to graduate with my colleagues, and they begin to think about dropping out of school, getting a job to help their families, a whole host of things. So we know that that is a critical transition point as well. The other thing we've been working really hard on, the 11 through 14 transition, is accelerated learning and making sure that we make sure that all students have an opportunity to take college classes in high school. We think this is critical because we know there's some students who never saw themselves as students who would go to college, but they take a college class in high school and they say, I can do it, I like it, I'm going to be the first in my family, or whatever, and all of a sudden they shift their frame about what they're going to do after high school. We also know, in terms of accelerated learning, that in order to get that deep partnership between high school and post-secondary, we're going to have to align our math curriculums and our language arts curriculum. So we're thinking of some resources to do that. Our post-secondary institutions are saying these courses have to be of high rigor at the same level they would be if they were at the community college or four-year college. We know alignment is really going to help us get there. We also know, as we move into post-secondary completion, that college needs to be accessible, it needs to be affordable, and students need to finish. So we're working very hard to recommend investments in that area. And of course, the last pathway is the pathway from education to careers. And what we know, the way we can get there are some major ways to get there. I mean, the first one is around high school equivalency. That is primarily around the new GED. And we know it's different, and we know it's a choice for many students, and we have to make sure our students are prepared, that the people who offer it know how to offer it and provide the support for kids to be successful. CTE, and making sure we have career technical education. I know Representative Reardon has been working hard on this with a lot of other people, but we know there's many, many students who learn best by hands-on and also learn best if they know what they're learning is going to apply immediately to a career. And some of them will choose to go right into the career and college ready, and later maybe go to college or at least work side-by-side with a community college to get a license or certificate that will be really meaningful to them, knowing all along that if they choose, they could decide later on to go into a STEM career, a science, technology, engineering, and math. We know there's many jobs in the STEM area. We also know that those jobs tend to be higher paying jobs, which also helps stimulate the economy in our state. In addition to that, we also are thinking about our youth who fall off the pathway. We have to make sure if students drop out along the way, we have a way to bring them back. We have a way to engage them because we know that an education is critically important for all of them. What you'll see up there is for all of these areas, we've got a measure by which we're targeting the increase that we're targeting. And so with that, I think I'm going to pass it on to Danny, who's going to talk a little bit about the governor's strategy.
Sure. So Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Springer, members of the committee, my name is Danny Ledesma. I'm the Education Policy Advisor for the governor. And I'd like to sort of follow up on what Nancy was saying about the outcomes. So we really approach this budget as a way to reinforce the outcomes that we'd like to achieve by looking at our investments really differently. So while Nancy told you about the content of the three pathways, I'd like to talk a little bit more about our approach to the types of investments. One of the things that I think that we're most proud of is that for every place where we looked at these key investments, we wanted to show a corresponding increase in outcomes. And this has been our attempt to really move the state from being a passive funder of education in general to being an active investor in outcomes and student achievement. So one of the things that we tried to look at the types of investments that we were making in four ways. The first strategy in the investments that we looked at was in wanting to make sure that we were increasing education funding throughout the entire continuum. And we wanted to really think about how do we really leverage our investments on what works, but also recognize that we needed to increase the education budget. The other strategy that we looked at was trying to think about how do we change incentives within the funding that we currently have to try to think about if there's a way that we could have more confidence in a different outcome or a better outcome. And so we have proposed several areas where we're doing that. The other component and the other type of investment that we're looking at is how do we think about the long-term systems change and the corresponding systems, such as teacher support, teacher collaboration and mentoring, as well as thinking about early learning hubs and collective impact and how local communities can really play a part in education and really support some of the outcomes that we want to see long-term, and how do we make investments that support those types of collaboration. And then, of course, we continue to look through the lens of our short-term strategic investments, really wanting to take lessons that we learned from our last round of funding for strategic investments and think about what could reasonably be accomplished within a biennium and how do we ensure that we're tying that investment to an outcome. So it was looking at these four types of investments that we, in addition to looking through the equity lens, that we started to analyze these different concepts. And basically what we were able to accomplish, if you will, thinking about a pyramid. So where the biggest and largest place of investment for the budget is really in ensuring that those base funding formulas, the base funding for education is the biggest part. We then suggested some modest changes to the state school fund, and we're suggesting modest changes to the allocation for the community college support fund and the the public university support fund. And then the systems change work, the system change work is a smaller investment, and then really the strategic investments are really seen as a sort of short-term burst of funding there. So it's through this strategy that we were able to think about and to really evaluate a lot of good concepts that came out of not only all of the different education agencies from the Early Learning Division to YDC to ODE and OEIB, but also the corresponding commissions and public bodies that support that. And so by doing that, we looked at what was the greatest return on the investment, or where did we see the biggest jump in outcomes? And we tried to really prioritize those. So we have a big list of potential investments, but these have been winnowed down, and we really think that these are the best investments that really sort of get us to the place where we're actively investing in student outcomes. Turn it over to Rod.
Chair Gelser, members of the committee, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Rob Saxton, for the record. Good to see all of you here today. It's been a little while. So I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that came out of the last session and then some of the things that we're looking at moving forward with in the upcoming session. So, and that are contained within the budget. We certainly learned a lot, I think, out of the out of 2 years ago and the work that we've been doing over the previous year and as we move forward into this year. And we want to make sure that with that learning that there are places where we should continue with some continuity. So we want to extend and continue to do or even build on some of the things that we did that we thought that really worked. And then we also want to make sure that we learn from some areas about what might have been able to go a little bit better and that there probably are some areas for refocus or changing our efforts or our methodology just a little bit. So a few examples of those things, I think some places where we were very, very pleased would be things like the collaboration grants from the school districts and our partnerships with the Chalkboard Project around that. The Eastern Promise scale-up across the state now. We have districts, community colleges, higher ed that are working together in partnership in a different way than they ever have before. And students have access to literally thousands of college credits while they're still in high school that they had not previously had access to. We have made a real commitment out of the last effort to make sure that the standards that we have adopted in the state of Oregon are college and career readiness standards and that there's a pathway for students as they take classes to make sure that they get the content that they need so that by the time that they graduate from high school, they are college and career ready. And because those are change standards, different than what we had previously, the teachers and administrators receive the support that they need to be able to utilize those standards with high quality and with additional effectiveness as compared to where they would have been, but for the fact that we had these efforts underway. That we have support for effective educators with our mentoring program, so first and second year teachers and administrators receive mentoring where they hadn't previously. And that we have mounted a significant effort to improve low-performing schools, and that schools are exiting that low-performing status, and that where children previously would have attended a school where their likelihood of success was smaller, it now is much, much greater than it was previously. We're working around cultural competency and diversifying our workforce, and significant commitment around science, technology, engineering, and math programs, and CTE programs that I've just had the pleasure of going around the state and looking at some of those STEM and CTE programs, and just am amazed at some of what I see in the motivation and enthusiasm that students have for their school and their futures that they wouldn't have had but for these efforts, and so really exciting things. We learned some things, like we came out with too many competitive grants, and so you'll see that the competitive grant process has diminished significantly, or that it seemed like in some ways some of the smaller school districts at the time were disadvantaged in that process and having equal access to all these efforts, and so that we've reduced some of that component as well. And as we move forward, you'll see some of the different things, and there's a couple that I want to point out very specifically. We have a couple that are, you know, around intended improved outcomes and closing of gaps. We have a couple specifically around closing the achievement gap for ELL students, making sure that students are on track as ninth graders, and then encouraging school districts to become even more engaged in CTE. And each of those that I just listed, those three, are all contain formula changes. And those formula changes really work with a very specific methodology. One is that there's an effort to incent outcomes, the kinds of outcomes that we want to have, and that these are within the current funding formula, current funding amount. There's no additional money for any of these. There would be formula changes that are being recommended. And so, for example, the ELL grant would increase, or the ELL process would increase the amount per student from 0.5 to 0.6. There would be an expectation that 90% of the resource would be spent on the ELL student, and that it would put a limit on the numbers of years that students would be in ELL and the district would continue to receive funding. So if a student was a very low level, what we would call level 1 or 2, English language learner, the district would receive funding for that student for 7 years. If they were level 3 or 4, which is a higher level and close to exit, they'd receive additional funding for 4 years. These changes are changes where we're currently still involved in the process of continuing our work on these, and so I want to acknowledge that we've continued to engage partners in really different ways we move forward and continuing to refine these. There's a strategy around ninth grade on track, and ninth grade on track would ask that for students who traditionally have been underserved, so students of color who qualify for free and reduced, our ELL, our special education, that if the district provides them with support of a summer school and after-school mentoring, and that the student earns 6 credits prior to their to the beginning of their sophomore year, and the student attends 90% of the time, that there's additional weight that's distributed within the formula of 0.045 for the student to earn to be on track earning 6 credits, and 0.005 for the student to be attending at least 90% of the days. And there also is one other one, that CTE, and that proposal would have the district receive an additional 0.1 weight if the student can earn 3 or more credits in an approved CTE career pathway, an additional 0.1 if that student is historically underserved, an additional 0.1 for the student who would be acquiring any kind of an industry credential, for a total of maximum of 0.3. Probably our most significant initiative is the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. This is a huge effort that I am incredibly excited about, and I know that we'll probably talk a little bit more about this when Megan Irwin, the early learning director, and I talk about early childhood and the age 3 to grade 3. But this really is an effort to make sure that we begin to look at the transition between early childhood and K-12 in a different way, and starting to actually put what we've called, a birth to college and career ready, or to college and career pathway into place, and really focusing on what takes place in that transition from early childhood into the K-12 world. And so within that, there's expectations around making sure that staff development that takes place is no longer staff development for kindergarten, first, second, and third grade teachers, but staff development that would take place regionally for people who are offering program to children from age 3 to grade 3, that we would look at alignment of standards within that. So we have a very specific set of standards, kindergarten to age 3, and we need to make sure that what happens in the early childhood component of that also lines up. And so getting people together so that we ensure that those standards make sense as students move forward. And then also ensuring that some methodologies are more similar than they have been previously. So we really talk about the kind of behavioral components that children bring into kindergarten, or at least we have too often in the past, and yet we teach perhaps a different system once they arrive in the K-3 system than was provided prior to that. And so certainly we can talk about what kinds of systems can you design that have students show up with a set of attributes that makes them more likely to be a learner as they move into kindergarten. Or that when we talk about what kind of reading methodology, how do we go about teaching this within this region and making sure that students are more likely to be readers by the end of third grade, that there's some coordination of that, which really requires the staff development component that I talked about. That we would have a handoff from early childhood into the K-3 realm, so that we're able to identify students who need additional support as they move forward, that they get a summer school program, and that their parents receive some support and opportunity for training prior to entering of kindergarten. And a lot of that is about ensuring that the parent feels empowered at their local school and knows how to engage in order to help their child, so there's some opportunity for learning around that, and that the child gets basically a 5-week summer school prior to showing up, and that we believe that we'll see changes in the kindergarten assessment that say that students are more ready to be learners when they come to kindergarten. And then for any student who is not making adequate progress or is not demonstrating that they're likely to become a reader by the end of third grade, that their summer school and after school program before first grade, second grade, and third grade, and after school program in kindergarten, first, second, and third grade. And that the kind of literacy that gets delivered within the K-3 realm is agreed upon within the area, within the school district, so that there's coordination between first grade teachers and all of the first grade teachers in one level, and then also up to first grade, for example, so that we know that the literacy instruction is coordinated in a way that's likely to bring best result. That also involves full day kindergarten, which I would be loath to forget. So in the entirety of the package, it's about $220 million for the full day kindergarten, and then another $85 million for the literacy package, and bringing that forward. So we know that if you look at the theory of action that Dr. Golden has put together, it's an excellent one, and we believe that with its implementation and the kinds of initiatives that we've outlined here, and especially with the age 3 to grade 3, that we can see some different kinds of outcomes for students, and that when children are readers by the end of third grade, that they're very likely to be successful into their futures. And so once again, some learning on our part on some of the programs that we put together, a continuation and refinement of many of those, and some new ones that I think will really move the dial. Happy to answer questions. Thank you.
All right. So Representative Parrish.
Thanks. Well, I appreciate hearing that. You know, when I was reading all the numerous articles about the governor's budget, and the third grade reading was mentioned in quite a few of them, what I did not see was an accountability mechanism discussion. I don't know if you've had that discussion, but in other states, you know, certainly with the emphasis on third grade reading, if the child isn't reading by third grade, there's no social promotion, or if the child isn't reading by third grade and is in a low performing school, the parent has a right to pick up their state school fund and go somewhere else if the school's not meeting those benchmarks. So I'm curious, you know, I appreciate the effort on third grade reading. We talked about that 4 years ago in this committee, didn't pass it then, but without an accountability metric in there, I worry that we're just throwing money at it, and then kids still aren't reading by third grade, and all we did was put more money into it. Is there some thought around what those accountability, you know, benchmarks are going to look like, or is that part of the plan?
Yes. Chair Gelser, Representative Parrish. I can talk about that a little bit, and then if I miss anything, I'd hope that you all would help me out with that. So there is an all-or-nothing mechanism to this as it's currently proposed, so full-day kindergarten, early learning component, and then also the K-3 component, so age 3 to grade 3, where if the dollars are available, and here's the expectation about what the totality of the program would look like. There's no, well, we want to pick this and choose that and just implement parts of it. It's an all-or-nothing expectation for the funding to come forward, which I think is really important. And then there also, for us, it's very important that we have a measurement mechanism that's built into the program that says, here's where students are, here's what our old benchmark looks like, here's what our new one looks like as far as the how well students are learning currently, and so we can identify that. And there are some assessments that have been given in the state over time, like there's one called EZCBM, or there's one called DIBLES that we have some baselining about. And then that we have students have an assessment, and we're able to look at the kindergarten assessment and see how that's changing over time with the early childhood component, and then that there is an assessment early, and then that we measure that assessment over time to see if students are making the kinds of gains that we would expect, and if there are schools or districts that are making greater gain than others. And then there would be a come alongside component, so that if there are some districts that are not making the kinds of gains that we would expect that others are making, that there would be support to try to improve upon their program, or to determine whether or not the program is being implemented with the kind of the same level of fidelity and effectiveness. At this point in time, we have not said, and there would be a you know, sort of a retention of the student, if you will, if they don't move forward.
So can I ask a clarifying question about what you just said?
Sure.
Thank you. So when we passed full day kindergarten, we said that it wasn't a mandate, that districts could choose whether to do it or not, and if they did, they would have the full weight. We are now telling people who are going to start offering full day kindergarten this year that they either are not going to get funded to continue full day kindergarten after this year, or they have to implement summer programs and after school programs. So they can't get the funding that they were promised for full day kindergarten unless they also add this full day summer program and after school program. And it doesn't appear that there is substantial money here that would wholly cover the cost of that across the state on top of the early childhood. Am I full day kindergarten? Am I missing something?
So what we've estimated is that the cost of full day kindergarten would be $220 million, and then the additional $85 million would be the cost that would cover the four components that Rob described as the sort of literacy program, that they would be sort of the all or nothing together. So that we were hoping that the theory of action would be one to sort of like, how can we really incentivize the system and sort of take the best practices from educators and districts to really encourage them to do the things that we know will work for students that will get us to that outcome. So I think we're happy to share the ways that we've looked at the costing out of each of those components. The idea is that $85 million would cover the state, but that there would be some time for scale up. So imagining that, you know, the budget would get passed sometime this spring or summer, that then it would take some time to scale that up for different districts. So it was that, is that your question around the cost?
Sort of. It's just the cost doesn't make sense to me. So if it's, and many districts are arguing that $220 million doesn't actually cover the full cost of full-day kindergarten. And if it's $220 million just to bump our kindergartners up half a day, I don't understand how $85 million is enough statewide to have quality after-school programs and summer programs. And you're going to have to open those up to all your special ed kids and ELL kids. So you're going to need interpreters and one-on-one aides and sure. all of those other pieces in there to make it accessible to everyone. I'm just wondering how this isn't sure. an additional... I'm worried about other things getting cut out with these changes in the formula, because it doesn't look like there's enough money here to make those changes without getting rid of social studies and other things and making enormous class sizes.
So, I'm sorry, Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Springer, members of the committee, we will share our sort of our estimates of costs and what they look like. That's the one. I have every other piece of paper except for the breakout of those okay. with me right now. But we can share those with you. We've I know that the department has used pretty conservative estimates and sort of looking at those, and we've sort of they've done good due diligence in sort of getting of what that would look like. But we'd welcome your feedback about those costs.
Right. Thank you. And I jumped to the queue. I know Representative Comp was next.
Oh, thank you, Chair Gelser. I just have two questions, but they're not light questions. One is referring to what the Chair is talking about. As being a member of the School Funding Task Force for the last 18 months, the question comes to mind for each one of these proposed funding formula changes. Have you done a run through legislative revenue to see what the impacts are for every district for each one of these changes? I think that information causes people to just go and gulp and gasp, but it's reality. And I would appreciate it if, you know, revenue and this committee and then we on the education sub also receive those. It would be very helpful.
Chair Gelser, Co-Chair Springer, members of the committee, thank you for your question, Rep. Comp. We have done an initial run for the ELL program, and we've shared that with the
right, I've seen
School
that.
Task Force. I don't believe we've done a run on the other ones that we shared publicly. One of the things that we're trying to do this is in collaboration with many of our different stakeholders. And so we put out these funding formula changes as a concept, have been asking for feedback. And so I think it's been a little bit of an iterative process, but we're certainly happy to share our estimates around that.
Yes. Follow up. My response would be, and I'd love to hear Deputy Superintendent Saxton's response, but this is December 8th, legislative session starting. I believe we as legislators need this information immediately. And then I had one other question after Deputy Superintendent.
Chair Gelser, Representative Comp. The other thing about each of these, less so with the ELL, and certainly the 0.6 run for ELL is something that's really easy to run and give out. I know that people have seen that. When it comes to the ninth grade on track and the CTE component, both of those are really outcome-based, and so it really is not, I don't know how you would do a run on that. You could be predictive of, what percent of students do we think in each district would be on track at the end of ninth grade? But really, the very essence of the design of this is to say to districts, this is a really important part of the pathway around success. And we know that when students are attending at least 90% of the time, they have 6 credits at the end of their ninth grade year, they're very likely to graduate from high school, like very likely in the 90% sort of thing realm. But what I can't predict is how each district would respond to that, and then how many of their students would actually achieve that, and then what kind of redistribution of resource that might cause. The same would really be true with CTE. So it might be one where you could be a little more predictive, where you say, well, here's a school where we know that they have a strong CTE program, and they've been able to have students earn 3 CTE credits. while this other school perhaps does not and has not. So we could make some predictions there, but any school could make the decision to ramp up their CTE program and then would have a different opportunity at the resource.
Go ahead. Can I follow up?
Yeah.
Thank you. And I agree with you completely that come the end of January, school districts, and I don't know that we've ever reported this, they will be able to tell you by looking at their freshman class who those ninth graders are. But you're right. I don't know that it's reported or any way that we could statistically begin to get there. But a high school can tell you almost dead on who's going to drop out at the end of the first semester. Moving on to a different question, and that is we have had multiple issues brought to us here at the legislature about transferability of college credits. And whether it's CTE credits, whether it's writing 121, 122, 123, or a history sequence, I am very concerned, and I believe we need some guidance to our higher ed partners. That's you. About to ensure that our students' credits count no matter which public university they go to. Could you speak to that a little bit?
So Representative Gelser, Representative Comp, that is one of the major functions of the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, is to really make sure there's common course numbers, that if you take a course at one university, it's going to transfer to another university. I think that's one of the reasons people were enthusiastic. I was enthusiastic about having a Higher Ed Coordinating Commission. In addition, in the work we've been doing around accelerated learning, where they're getting, according to the Achievement Compacts, 3 college credits in high school, we're talking about making sure those courses are ones that would work with no matter what major you have and no matter what university. When you get that, that is going to transfer. It's one of those core classes that you would need with every single discipline. So Representative Huffman's been working on the Accelerated Learning Committee. This has been a real issue for the committee, and we do have legislation that we believe is really going to get at that.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Gomberg.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Ms. Golden, Ms. Ledesma, and Mr. Saxon for this overview. My question is, could you talk to me briefly about what this new budget is going to do, if anything, to better support our special needs students in reaching their full potential and the districts that are trying to work with them?
Representative Gomberg and Representative Gelser, I think we both can talk about that. One thing for sure, in the K-3 reading, there are models like the response to intervention model, which really allows you, the day a student comes to school, first of all, working with early learning around if a child is on an IEP, they call it something a little different when they're little, but that there's a strong transfer with that. But a lot of it has to do with the structures you put in place in K-3. So the response to intervention really creates a multi-tiered model where, for example, walk to read, where if students are at the point in first grade where they're learning their sounds, there's a group to go to. If they're at a place where they can read books, there's a place to go. And then there's a place where all kids can learn together. I think the only difference and the thing that I think is really exciting about this model is one of the issues around response to intervention is that most children get 90 minutes of reading, but then if you need extra, you get 120 minutes. But that's taken out of all of the fun activities, like getting to do social studies or getting to do science or getting to be in art. And so the summer school and after school really allows a place where kids can get caught up on the basic skills. So when they're in school, they can have a full curriculum just like every other child. And once students are much more on track together, it does allow a much bigger opportunity for the teacher to do the accommodations they need for special special ed children because they don't have kids at 10 different places. They have most kids on track, and then sometimes with special needs children, you do need to make additional accommodations just for the unique learning style. So we believe this model would create an opportunity to meet the needs of all the students.
And Chair Gelser, Representative Gomberg, if you would humor me, I'd answer as well. So one of the really important things about an effective early literacy program is that it ensures that students are going to have their best opportunity to be readers by a given age. And we know that too often when we are unsuccessful in having students learn to read, that they end up being special ed identified. We also know that when we have really highly effective early reading programs, that they are able to provide the students with quick assessments, make some determination through that assessment about where the learning deficit might be. So we might know this happens to be a phonemics problem, so they have a hard time sort of sounding out the letters kinds of thing. Or this happens to be a fluency problem, where the speed with which they read and then the comprehension that comes together don't match. And then we're able to focus specifically on helping the child overcome that issue with very specific efforts that oftentimes children who later are identified as eligible for special education are not identified. They actually overcome a learning challenge that they had, are able to be readers, and never should have been identified as special ed in the first place. I think it's part of the reason we have a huge disparity in the identification of students in the state around special ed. We have some districts as low as 10% and some districts as high as 20%. And part of it is the effectiveness around teaching early literacy. And we need to make sure that we teach it well so we don't do that anymore, because we're identifying kids that are not and do not have a learning disability. The other couple of places where we have this is the ninth grade on track, the ELL, and the CTE. So ELL, I would say there is a similar issue, is that when we don't do a good job of being really intensive about helping children overcome their lack of English skill, that sometimes we get down the road and they're unable to access content information, so that when they take an assessment, because they're trying to access that content in English, or they're unable to access the content in Spanish, when they take an assessment down the road, it looks like they don't know very much. When in truth, it's just because they haven't been able to access the material because they don't understand the language. So getting to that quickly, I think, helps around the identification of special education students. And then in ninth grade on track and CTE, both of those have components for additional resource and additional support for students who, are traditionally underserved, and that includes students who are special education students. So if there's a student who's a special education student, if the district provides that student with a summer school opportunity before their ninth grade year and or before their 10th grade year, and provides them with mentoring over the course of their freshman year, and the student earns 6 credits, there's an additional resource. And it incents districts to look at these kids who need extra and give them extra with the resource that would be provided. And really, the CTE program works the same way. An additional 0.1 for students who are underserved that earn 3 CTE credits or earn an industry certificate, another 0.1. And so it incents districts to pay special attention and make sure that those students have opportunities with resources that they previously haven't had.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So it makes sense to me that you would incent things. What I'm still struggling with is that it's really kind of a hold steady budget in terms of the buying power of the budget. So for it really to be an incentive for a district, wouldn't it have to be additional money rather than money that's wrested away from something else? So for example, ninth grade on track, $18 million. That ninth grade on track doesn't just happen in the ninth grade. It happens earlier. And $18 million across the state isn't a whole lot of money. So I don't see where that covers all of those programs. And back to the kindergarten piece, the other place that I'm hung up on the incentive, do we risk breaking a promise that the legislature made to all of the school districts out there that in good faith are going to start full-day kindergarten. Because aren't we saying, do all these things with really limited additional resources, if any, as it all comes out in the wash, or you're not going to get your full-day kindergarten reimbursement. So they're either going to have to go tell their families, we're not offering this anymore, which creates huge disruption in the community, or they're going to have to cut middle school programs or other programs. The same thing with CTE. If we're incenting high schools to do more CTE, doesn't that make it even harder for high schools to offer the pre-algebra that students are needing? Because right now, ninth graders aren't completing the ninth grade because they're not completing Algebra 1, and our high schools can't afford to have more pre-algebra teachers. So help me understand how these incentives work when there really isn't more money. It's just pulling them into more restricted silos.
Sure. So Chair Gelser, members of the committee, so I think one of our approaches to the budget was to think about increasing funding for education throughout the continuum. So you'll see a significant investment in early learning, $135 million for early learning, as well as significant increases on the higher ed side, as well as an increase to K-12. We're proposing over $7.2 billion that would support K through 12. That we see as an increase. And so I think our approach was is that we wanted to, like you said, make sure that we have a strong enough base of funding at $7.2 billion, but also think about, well, within that $7.2 billion, are there ways that we can change our practice within the current allocation to try to get reasonably expect some more increased outcomes? So for all of those three system incentives, the three formula changes, in total, they equal $119 million. $119 million of the state school fund, as proposed by the governor's recommended budget, is roughly 1.7% of the budget. So when we talk about like how we're trying to make this and how these incentives will effectively work, it's essentially a reallocation of less than 2% of the entire state school fund. So we tried to really approach this modestly, recognizing that we did want to make sure that we were not jeopardizing the entire business on the risk of these formula changes, but we did think that it was important enough, and we did hear from many stakeholders that there may be some incentives and some ways that we can expect greater outcomes by looking at these incentives. I would say the other thing is that if you look at the $119 million, that is less than the proposed increase in the state school fund. So I think that, you know, our approach again was to sort of look at this increase at the base, to look within the base and see how we could maybe change practice, and then think about long-term systems change work by supporting educators, supporting collective impact, and then really looking at strategic investments as a way to really kind of provide that injection of investment to think about how we can change things. So I think that we approached the budget with the same concerns that you have. I think that the way that we've looked at this budget is that we see that sort of pyramid of investment types. I think the governor wanted to take the opportunity to think about all the different types of levers that are available to us as a state beyond just looking at being a passive investor in education, but really wanted to sort of say, well, where are all the opportunities that we can get to outcomes, and let's propose concepts and make sure that we're refining them.
So I think where I'm stuck, though, and I appreciate that there's an increase, but when I'm talking to school districts and school board members and administrators, they're telling me that even with this increase, and we increase every year because things get more expensive, fuel gets more expensive, heat gets more expensive, health insurance gets more expensive. Our staff have had frozen salaries for a really long time. We'd like to keep them. That this budget that we have is still, even with this increase, is still a cuts budget for some districts. And when you're living in an environment of cuts upon cuts upon cuts, 2% out of a budget that's starving still leaves you with nothing to eat. So what are you hearing back from administrators and school boards? Are they supportive of these proposals? Did you work with this 18-month state school fund formula task force to work with them in those discussions around the formula changes? What role did you play in that legislative process?
Sure. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, I would say that we're hearing pretty similar feedback from administrators and from school board members. We do hear individually from some administrators or from some school board members that there is a need to want to do things differently. We hear, you know, our charge is really to think about the whole broad range, and I think one of the things that makes our charge for education effective is that we're able to pull from a really diverse set of stakeholders. When you think about our state, you have so many people who are engaged and want the best for our students. We recognize we're really unique in that we have a state where everyone recognizes that our future is really dependent on how well and how well we can improve education outcomes for students. And so I think sort of thinking about the full broad range of stakeholders, we hear both arguments. I think that we've heard from a lot of parents and families, organizations that say, you know, we think that this is, it's important to increase funding for education, and it's also important to expect that we maybe think about doing differently with the funding that we have to try to increase outcomes. You know, many folks point to that our outcomes for many of the populations that we pointed out that we've tried to target, even with full funding, we still had significant gaps. And so I think we're trying to balance this multitude of perspectives to try to make sure that we're really trying to do best for students and to increase their outcomes.
And just one more question before we go to Representative Reardon. When did we have full funding?
I apologize if I misspoke. I think what I meant to say was that when I've heard folks who say that when we've had higher rates of funding prior to the recession, that we still had significant gaps. I apologize.
And I think the important thing to look at in that's still a post Measure 5, 47, and 50 environment, and our schools have been grossly underfunded since the 1990s. I know my school district has had to make cuts, the school district that my kids attend, every single year with the exception of 2007 and this last school year. So I've never seen our educators have the resources that they need to do all these things. And I want to clarify, I think these are great things. I would love to be able to do them. I would love to see after school programs and summer programs and more CTE and really focusing on that ninth grade improvement. And I mean, all of those things are wonderful. But I don't, I just worry that we haven't added in the resource to do it. And I think for these things to move successfully through the process, it's going to be hard if the educators that are working with the kids every day, the teachers, the administrators, the school board members, aren't on board waving a flag saying, we're confident that we can do this, and we can do this without cutting math. We can do this without cutting transportation. We can do this without cutting civics and PE and all of the other things that are important for kids. Representative Reardon.
Oh, thank you. I think just follow on to what Chair Gelser was saying. It just, I could use some additional clarification on, you know, what is the base? What were we doing the last biennium? If you add a couple hundred million or whatever we agree that figure is for all day kindergarten on top of that, if we add on cost of living or normal increases, that's the new base. If I could just get a number that corresponds to that, just for the sake of communication, it would be very helpful, because I had the same pushback from my local superintendents as well as, and I'm sitting there trying to really advocate for new strategies, and I certainly, particularly you talk CTE, I get all excited, and the ELL, but we need to know what that base is, and let's be honest, you know, we're like a couple billion shy of the QEM, and so how do we play there? But for communications with my constituents, it'd be really helpful to have it build up from that base. What are we playing with here?
Sure.
Because I hear different numbers depending on who I talk to.
Sure. Chair Gelser, Rep. Reardon. So the numbers that we've worked off from was that the legislatively approved budget had a state school fund of $6.65 billion,
yeah,
give or take a few decimals, and that what we're proposing is the governor's recommended budget is a state school fund of $6.9143 billion, which is roughly a 3.9% increase. This is inclusive of a $220 million investment for all-day K. And
It includes
the all-day K, and we're happy to share our assumptions about what that looks like, sort of how we got to $220 million for that as well.
Okay, so I better understand how you got there. I'm not sure I would have done it quite that way, but okay.
Thanks. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. I don't think I'm yet clear on how the process for districts to receive the money. Is it through a similar grant writing process that was subscribed to 2 years ago with the initiatives? How will they receive the dollars?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I wasn't clear about what you say.
The initiatives here, the strategic investments.
Thank you. My apologies. So there's a number of different mechanisms, but by and large, we've moved away from the grant funding mechanism pretty significantly. I think there'll be a couple places where that takes place, and that for the most part, it would be there are two components. One is we're an acknowledgement that they're going to participate in the program, and then a distribution of resources based on average daily membership weighted. And then also on some of these, like the ELL or the Ninth Grade On Track or the CTE, just like what districts always do, they would need to predict what their ADMW, their average daily membership weighted, would be. So usually in the springtime, a district tries to figure out how many students are we going to have next year. We used to hire a demographer from Portland State to try to help us with that. And then we would try to figure out how many special ed students do we think we're going to have, how many pregnant parenting teens, all the things that add additional weight to the formula. And then we would tell the state that's how many students we're going to have, and they would provide us with the funding for that. So in things like the ELL and the Ninth Grade On Track, we would ask districts to make an estimate how many students are going to earn 6 credits at the end of ninth grade or earn 3 CTE credits. And so how many students are you going to have? We'll give you the funding for that. And then, as is typical, after about a year and a half, there's a date of reconciliation, right? This is how many you really did have or didn't have, and then we need to balance that. We either need to give you some more or you need to give us some back. But it would be distributed through the ADMW formula, is the short answer.
Second question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair Gelser asked a great question. I didn't hear the answer to it. What, if any, conversation is taking place with the task force for the school fund, state school fund, which I've been a part of? Are there conversations occurring with them? Because I'm getting a sense there's two separate pieces of work going on here.
Yeah, sure. Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, I think the place where we engaged the most with the school funding task force was around the ELL formula change. Mm-hmm. I think there was a pretty robust discussion about that particular formula change at the school funding task force and not on the other two.
Thank you.
I have one more question. Is there a proposal elsewhere for infrastructure investments to kind of handle the increased infrastructure needs for before school and after school programs, preschool programs, and increased CTE programs for districts? I know some districts are telling me that they are struggling with infrastructure around implementation of full-day kindergarten, and all of these initiatives require space as well as people.
Yes, thank you, Chair Gelser. There is not around full-day kindergarten or the after-school programs. There is within CTE. So within the CTE program and some of the grants that have been, not within the CTE formula change, but within the CTE scale-up grants, replication grants, there are some dollars that are available for the machinery and that kind of thing that it takes to run a CTE program.
Any last questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And personally, I'm not worried about the funding for full-day kindergarten because I remember a conversation with now Congresswoman Bonamici, and I asked her, I said, so, you know, you're awfully excited about this, and I'm supportive too, but what about the money? And she said, it's 2014, John. The money will be there. So I trusted Suzanne, and here we are. And lo and behold, the money's there. I'm excited about the policy discussions that we're going to have going into the next session. Echo some of the concerns of my colleagues about the base funding portion of it. And it's it's going to be interesting as we move forward. I'm going to ask the speaker to not put me on the education subcommittee to determine what the budgets are so that I can rant and rave and yell, you know, without having to actually. But, you know, I think most of us are very supportive of what we hear about, you know, the direction that we're trying to head, third grade reading and full-day kindergarten. It's hard to argue with the direction we're trying to head to get people ready. But I do think, as I mentioned this morning in higher ed, that I am concerned about all the education budgets. I think we're asking our school districts, we're asking our community colleges, higher ed, to do things for 40-40-20, for example, but not giving them adequate resources. And you know, at some point, we're just teasing ourselves up here at the dais and state in general if we go, yep, 40-40-20, it's a nice pet. We just keep petting it, but we don't feed it. And, you know, 2025 is going to be here before we know it. And if we're grossly underfunding community colleges, for example, which is an integral part of that middle 40, we're just not going to get there. And I see community colleges contracting right now, not doing what they need to meet that middle 40. And so I'm concerned. So I think it's going to be some great discussion going into the session. But thank you for all your work. I know it's been a tremendous amount of work. I know I only had to sit on one of the task forces, and so there's been a lot of work going into what we're going to be discussing.
Well, thank you all very much for coming and for taking difficult questions. I think Representative Springer said something that really resonated to me, that it seems almost like there are two processes. And the things that are in here, again, the ideas are phenomenal in terms of the goals of what we're trying to accomplish. But the mechanical piece of making changes to the state school fund, that is an enormous lift that's extremely difficult, and that cannot happen without direct engagement of the legislature. And the context that we sit in is that the legislature just had this task force that worked for 18 months, had stakeholders from all over the state that came back and said, we should not change the state school fund at this time. So that's a pretty big hill to climb to get changes through in the next 3 months. So I hope that we can move into more of a unified plan, because ultimately there has to be a majority of the legislature to make those changes. And to get there, I think there's going to need to be more direct engagement with members so we can get to the goals we all share. Again, the ideas are great. It's just the process and what we're hearing from our districts is a lot of fear about the adequacy of the money that's there.
Thank you.
Thank you all very much. All right. With that, I am going to close the information hearing on the Governor's Education Initiatives. And I'm going to open an informational meeting on the Early Learning and Youth Development Divisions. You can just stay right there. It's your lucky day. And Megan and Iris are coming up too.
Madam Chair, while they're coming up, Megan came out to the Dalles and went to a couple of early learning settings with me. Had a great time. I would encourage anybody to maybe lasso her and get her to come and go with you. But you know, it was another example to me of how funding is connected with Columbia Gorge Community College and early learning there. And so if we don't fund community colleges adequately, it's going to affect the workers in the early learning child care situations that I have in the district. So, you know, I'm hoping everybody's asking a lot of questions about cause and effect as we move forward.
Thank you. Welcome. And colleagues, we're going to do the same thing, presentation and then questions. Can we keep going? We're not voting on anything, so we don't need a quorum.
Yes, Madam Chair. All right. Chair Gelser, members of the committee, thank you so much for inviting me here to speak with you today. For the record, my name is Megan Irwin, and I'm the Acting Early Learning System Director, which means I have oversight of the Early Learning Division, which is a division inside ODE. Rob was invited to come with me today, and we're actually going to open with him sharing some of his thoughts and his realizations as a former K-12 superintendent around just how critical early childhood is to our state achieving its 40-40-20 goals, and then I'll walk through some of the highlights from the work we've been doing, being very aware of time and wanting to make sure my colleague Iris has the chance to speak too.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, Deputy Superintendent of Public Instruction, Rob Saxton. Good to see you all again.
Long time no see.
It actually is, you know, really wonderful to be able to sit in this chair and not move, not because I don't want to, you know, go sit someplace else, but just because it really talks about what it is that we're trying to build here. A birth through college and career ready continuum that makes a lot of sense along the pathway, and no place better probably than in early childhood. And we look at our 40-40-20 goals. I really appreciated the comments that Representative Huffman made about 2025. A few years ago, we thought, 4 years out for full day K, and we've got lots of time, and there'll be an economic recovery, you know, that will be more substantial perhaps than the one that we've had. And it'll all work out perfect, and it won't. It doesn't all work out perfect unless we're really intentional about what it is that we're attempting to do. We can't get to 40-40-20 unless we're really intentional right now during this session. And if we aren't really intentional about what's happening in the early learning division and what's happening within the greater K-12 Department of Education and how that plays out and what takes place in the state every single day, we know that the investment in early learning is the best investment that we can make when it comes to long-term return on investment, long-term ROI. And then move into an age 3 to grade 3 and the outcome on third grade reading and ninth grade on track. Those are all places that are really the sweet spot on making an investment and making sure that we get to 40-40-20. I know that I think about as a superintendent what I used to think as a K-12 superintendent out in the state in our old system. And it was that students were going to arrive in kindergarten and they were going to arrive how they arrived. And that I used to say to our early staff, you know, our kindergarten through age 3 staff, grade 3 staff, we have a hair on fire emergency to ensure that our students are going to be readers by the end of third grade, and we have 4 years to get the work done. And, you know, in this role, and as we look at the state and think about it in a different way, that's not true anymore. We still have an emergency to make sure that kids are reading by the end of third grade, but we have 8 years to get that work done. And if we're really thoughtful and we can leverage the early learning part of it and make it transition smoothly into the K-3 part of it, I think we can achieve that in a different way than we've ever done before. Randy Shield, the superintendent of the year this year, is the superintendent of the Tillamook School District. And I've told Randy this before, the kids in his district are lucky that he's the superintendent because he makes a difference in the educators in that community, and then the community coming together as a whole makes a difference in the kinds of outcomes and the kinds of life experience that these kids are going to have because of the education program they have in Tillamook. And Randy talks about what happens at the Tillamook Creamery, that they don't just let people deliver the cream to the creamery door and say, now we're going to make cheese out of it, and that's just the way it goes. And, oh, by the way, some of it doesn't meet our quality standard, and so we're going to have to turn it back, or we're going to have to put intensive work into it to make it turn into the ice cream and the cheese that we appreciate in Tillamook. But instead, when that happens, we're going to turn around and figure out how we're going to support the farmer so that they have the cream content and the quality that's needed when it gets delivered to the creamery door to make sure that they're going to be able to work with that in a way that's most effective and going to get the kind of outcome that they want. And why would we pay more attention to cream than we would to the children in our community? And that really is what this piece is about. And so, it is about us working together to think about how to build those links and create program and incentive and encourage people across the state to make sure that we're having students delivered in the very best way to the schoolhouse door, and then that we're really smart about what we do with them throughout the rest of the program.
Great. Thanks, Rob. I just want to call out how incredibly special it is for Oregon to have a deputy superintendent of public instruction with a K-12 background who understands what Rob just said. And the other thing that I want to call out is how special it is for Oregon to have its Department of Early Learning actually inside the Department of Education. Early childhood departments and early childhood programs are not always in the Department of Education in states around the country. And the fact that this legislature has recognized that the work that goes into supporting child development prior to the start of formal schooling as a core part of our education system is something that really needs to be celebrated. And actually, one of the big structural successes from the last 2 years, we've only been part of the Department of Education since July of 2013. So I was asked to come to talk with you today to talk about what we've been doing over the last 2 years to build Oregon's early learning system. I'm going to start with a very brief review of how we got here and then talk a little bit about one or two of the key initiatives under each of our goal areas. There's so much to talk about. I'd be happy to come back at any time and go deep into any one of the things that I'm going to lay out today. There's been a tremendous amount of work happening in the Early Learning Division since we were created just about 18 months ago. So just to remind folks, when he was elected in 2010, the governor convened an early learning transition team and tasked them with the responsibility of coming up with a set of recommendations for how to achieve these goals, for how to ensure that children are ready when they arrive at school, that they're readers by third grade, that they grow up in families that are stable with a caregiver, an adult who they're attached to, and that we're integrating our services and resources across the early learning system statewide. And these goals are really important because, unfortunately, 40%, about 40% of the 45,000 children who are born in our state every year are exposed to a well-recognized set of socioeconomic, physical, and relational risk factors that we know adversely impact their brain development early in life and interrupt the foundations that are necessary for later success in school. And this slide just highlights some of the results of that interruption. I won't belabor it. I think everyone on this committee understands the risk factors facing our kids and our families. So the transition team that was pulled together by the governor developed a set of recommendations, many of which later became pieces of legislation that this body put into place to support the creation of an early learning system. And here you see some of them highlighted. I won't read them to you, but one thing that I always like to point out is in the first couple of years of this work, a lot of the legislation that was passed was structural, like creating an early learning division to manage the system, creating statewide early learning standards for both infants and toddlers and 3-, 4-, and 5-year-olds, and creating our early learning hub system across the state. And some of the work was programmatic. We did an additional increase in programs like our children's relief nurseries and the Oregon pre-kindergarten program, and we've been able to expand home visiting to subsequent births. So there was some programmatic work that happened and a lot of structural work that happened. The other thing I always like to point out is that the work that we've done as the Early Learning Division over the last biennium has predominantly been done within existing resources, pulling from a variety of state agencies to create the division. And then we were lucky enough to receive a federal Race to the Top Early Learning Challenge grant, which has accelerated some of our systems building work. And so what I'd like to do is just walk you through, again, a couple of highlights around our early learning work under each of our core areas of focus, starting with our goal around stable and attached families. So our work in this area requires an incredibly strong partnership with the health system. The reason for that is that, as you'll see later, children in Oregon are in a variety of formal and informal settings before they arrive at school. The one place they show up consistently before entering school is the doctor's office. About 90% of our kids show up at the doctor's office between the time they're born and the time that they start school. So we know that if we're serious about identifying children and families who need extra support as early as possible, then our best opportunity to do that is at the hospital, at the doctor's office, and at the public health clinic. And so we've been doing quite a bit of work over the last couple of years to really build out that connection to healthcare formally. To guide that work, we created a joint committee between the Oregon Health Policy Board and the Early Learning Council. And you see on the slide some of the areas that they've chosen to focus on. The one I wanted to call out specifically to your attention and to have you thinking about is this last bullet around developing a statewide system for developmental screening and early identification. So we have adopted a universal developmental screening tool. It's called the Ages and Stages Questionnaire, and it's currently being used by both both early childhood providers and healthcare providers mm-hmm. to assess on-track development in young children. Our goal is to increase screening for children before age 3 and to identify potential delay or disability as early as possible and then refer those children for further evaluation and services if they need it. We're also in the process of considering a universal family risk assessment so that we can have the same kind of consistency in how we're addressing risk factors that don't have to do with physical or cognitive development and wrap those same kinds of supports around families. In the coming years, now that we have an increased focus on developmental screening and a universal tool that we're using, our work with the health authority and with DHS is really focusing on how do we build out stronger referral follow-ups. A lot of families are referred for evaluation for programs like early intervention, early childhood special education, and then never make it to the evaluation appointment, or they get to the evaluation appointment and they never show up for service, and we think that we have a role in figuring out how we build a better and stronger, more supportive referral pathway there. Also on the family stability front, we're working with partners in public health to look at how we can better align home visiting investments and home visiting services so that they're focused on families versus focused on programmatic needs. So that's work to still come. Moving on to our goal related to kindergarten readiness, you can see some of our key kindergarten readiness strategies here. What I will probably focus on just in light of time is going deeper into our work on the quality rating improvement system, just because childcare is such a big part of where kids are in our state, and I want to make sure that this body has an understanding of that. Is that okay with you?
Yes, please.
Okay. Okay. So Rob had some things he was going to say, but we're just going to move on. Moving on to talk about the quality rating improvement system as one of our core school readiness strategies. This is one of the largest initiatives that we've taken on in our effort to help children arrive at kindergarten prepared for school. And it really focuses on working with regulated child care providers in our state to develop their programs into true early learning and development environments versus places where children are simply going during the day to be watched. And so this initiative is called the Quality Rating Improvement System. We're in the 6th month of statewide rollout, and it's important because, as you can see, a large portion of our children are in child care. A really large portion of our children are at home with their parents, but we're trying to build out strategies to improve the quality of early learning and development programs where children are in regulated care. To address the range of quality that exists within regulated care, which some of you have had the opportunity to see firsthand doing community visits with me, we've established an escalating scale of standards through the quality rating improvement system, where the baseline is licensing, and then the next step up is a commitment to actually develop an early learning program within your licensed child care home or facility, and then there's escalating levels of quality standards that go up from there. We really have 3 goals with the QRIS. The first is focused on children. Most importantly, we want to make sure that children have the opportunity to access high-quality early learning environments because we know from a lot of brain research how important that is for success in school. Our second goal is really focused on the I in the QRIS, the improvement piece, which means a lot of professional development and support and additional financial incentives for childcare providers who want to get up to those levels of quality, but need some help to figure out how to do that. And our third goal is for this to become almost a consumer protection type of program for families as they're selecting childcare, to know if you're selecting care at the 3-star level or higher, that you really are selecting an environment where there is a formal early learning and child development focus happening in the home. And at the same time as we're doing that, we're working to build out our child care subsidy program so that families who are low income but also working are able to actually purchase and afford higher levels of quality child care. How am I doing on time? I'm really conscious of the fact that the committee is supposed to end at 3:30.
I probably don't have the best answer, but I think if we just keep moving at a brisk pace, we'll be good.
Great.
And the chair will be back very shortly.
Okay. So the next piece that I wanted to highlight for the committee is our work around connecting to K-3. You heard from Rob what that looks like on the age 3 to grade 3 literacy initiative. We began in 2013 and 2014 to lay some foundations that would start to let these two systems connect. One of the most important things that we did is actually establish early learning standards across the state, as well as a kindergarten assessment that measures 3 domains of those standards. Our early learning standards are pulled from the Head Start Child Development Framework, which looks at 5 core areas of learning and development: approaches to learning, language and literacy, cognition and general knowledge, physical development, as well as health and social and emotional development. And that framework is used on the early childhood side to guide curriculum and selection, as well as planning and assessing teaching and learning and professional development for our providers. And then we built a kindergarten assessment in this state that measures 3 of those 5 domains that I just mentioned. The kindergarten assessment looks at approaches to learning, as well as language and literacy, and mathematics knowledge, which is a portion of the cognition and general knowledge part of our early learning standards framework. The results of the 2013 kindergarten assessment certainly supported the need for a stronger connection around literacy between early childhood and K-3 education, which is a major focus of ours as we move towards some ambitious third grade reading goals. And I don't know, but I suspect that the 2014 assessment results will point us in that same direction. We are working to build a foundation to support what we call P3 alignment, or age 3 to grade 3. The first way that we've started building this out in a small way through demonstration projects in this biennium was through a fund called the Kindergarten Partnership Innovation Fund, which does a lot of the things that Rob mentioned in his previous presentation, but on a smaller scale. We have 16 grantees across the state doing that work right now, and it's really provided us some proof of concept that we think we can take to scale through initiatives like the age 3 to grade 3 literacy piece. I want to pause to give Rob the chance to say anything that he didn't say in the last presentation related to connecting the work of early childhood to the work of the early grades of elementary school.
I actually think I said it all.
Okay, great. So I'll move us quickly to our final, the final piece that I wanted to highlight for you all, which is the work that we've been doing around coordinating the early learning system. So historically in Oregon, there was a wide range of public, private, and nonprofit programs, services, and organizations, all focused on early childhood education and family support, all caring a lot about those families, but not necessarily working in concert, and most were disconnected from the education system. The conversation with this committee about early childhood education is relatively new, and us being part of education is relatively new. And this is what the early learning system looked like previously. Since the legislature adjourned in July 2013, we've made big progress in streamlining the system. The Early Learning Division exists inside ODE and has taken many of the messy programs from the first slide under its wing. And it's been a pretty massive internal shift. We moved child care, preschool, and most of the state's home visiting programs into the division under the Department of Education, along with a variety of new initiatives. At the same time as we've been managing that internal shift, we've been pushing an external change around coordination of early learning services at the community level through our early learning hubs. The hubs have 5 core responsibilities, which you can see are here up on the screen. The outcomes that they're responsible for accounting for are the same ones that the division is responsible for: school readiness, stable families, coordinated system. And they're required to work across healthcare, human services, early childhood, K-12 education, and the private sector. And we could probably do a whole long presentation just on the hubs, but we won't do that today. The hubs have been very much in startup mode. We currently have 14 established, with the last 2 on track for certification and contract by the end of the biennium. Our early focus was on doing the things organizations do in startup mode, building a strategic plan, identifying the right governance structures. But they have been able to start to make some investments in their communities that make a real impact. One of my favorite stories related to that is the early learning hub that serves Marion and Polk County, where we're sitting right now, was given a small early literacy investment that they've been able to partner with the 10 public health clinics in Marion County that serve 90% of the kids in this county that are on the Oregon Health Plan to have them receive an evidence-based literacy program called Reach Out and Read. Seems like such a small thing. That's the kind of thing that as a state agency we never would have thought to do, because we never would have had a way to know that most of the kids on the Oregon Health Plan in Marion County go to these 10 clinics. So it's just kind of a small example of how we've been able to start to put resources through the hubs to get them more effectively out into communities than we're able to do as a state agency. I have lots more examples like that that I'm happy to share. In terms of who's running the hubs, we have four that are managed by nonprofits, one in Central Oregon that's managed by an intergovernmental agency, one that's managed by a county, one that's managed by a coordinated care organization, one managed by a community college, and six that are managed by education service districts across the state. So kind of a mix. The oldest hub came under contract in February. The youngest hub came under contract last week. So it's still a system that's being built, but early signs are really positive. I'll stop there to hopefully take a few questions and then give Iris the chance to speak. And I look forward to doing a lot more conversation and hopefully a lot less rushed of a presentation next time I get to meet with all of you in session.
Thank you, Megan. Questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Megan, early on in your presentation when you were talking about a risk assessment for, children, you also mentioned briefly conversations that are taking place about a universal family risk assessment. What would that look like? Tell me a little bit about that.
That's a great question. So most, Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, members of the committee, most of the conversation that the two policy boards are having around that is starting from a place of looking at the questionnaires that home visiting programs currently use. So a program like Healthy Families Oregon has a family risk screener that's used when mom has a baby at a hospital. The nurse asks questions to try to understand, is there maternal depression going on? Is there domestic violence? Is there a history of drug use? Just all of the risk factors that could make it challenging for mom to form a strong attachment with the baby. And then if you reach a certain threshold, you get referred into the program. So looking at those kinds of risk factors, but trying to get to a place where we're selecting an assessment screener that's not tied to a specific program.
Follow up?
So how would that information be used, and how much of it would be voluntary? If I'm asked a question, I can just say, I'm not going to answer that, or I can give you an answer. But if you are assessing me, then that is no longer voluntary.
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, members of the committee, fabulous question. It's all voluntary. So you can absolutely decline not to be screened for additional services. If you are, it's used confidentially to refer to a program that meets your needs. But every part of the early learning system in our state is voluntary.
Well, this has been going on, though, quite a while, hasn't it? This isn't a new thing, right?
Correct.
What I'm going back to 17 years ago at the hospital, talking about our birth plan, they'd ask my husband to step out of the room, and they said, do you feel safe at home? I made a joke because I didn't think they were serious. So that's been going on 17 years. And, yes, I felt safe at home, and I still do. So what's new? What's different? And why the change in conversation around it?
That's correct. Chair Gelser, Representative Springer, members of the committee, that's correct. The way that screening's done right now, though, is done program by program. So if your county has Healthy Families Oregon and they're partnered with the hospital that you're at, you'll get the Healthy Families screener. If your county is partnered with Nurse Family Partnership and they're partnered with the hospital that you're at, you get screened by them. What we're trying to do is move away from screening people into a program based on that program existing where they are and whether or not it meets the family's actual need, and moving to a place where we're screening folks and then referring them into a program that meets their needs. which is a little bit challenging to do because there's turf around my program best meets everybody's needs. No, my program does. We're trying to move away from thinking about that and get to a place of universal family-focused screening and then referral based on what the actual identified needs are, not which program exists where and has a partnership with which hospital. I don't know if that makes sense.
My last follow-up comment.
Sure.
I don't completely understand yet. That's okay.
We'll keep working on it.
And we'll keep working on it. I do have a concern that we're talking about early learning hubs, and now we have broadened the discussion to say talk about appropriate programs for families that are at risk, and then how that information would be kept, how it would be used, how it would be shared, which programs. So as we continue this conversation, I'd like a whole lot more information about that, and I certainly have a level of uncomfortableness as this conversation feels like it's now expanded.
Duly noted, and I'll do some follow-up with you with some additional information. Thank you.
I thought I saw a hand over there, but I couldn't tell if it was a Gomberg hand or a Huffman hand, or no hand at all.
No, but if, Madam Chair, if I could share just a moment. I did go last Wednesday, I think it was, on a home visit, and it was prearranged, and so I was able to ask the mother, so how did you get in touch with the, how did you get hooked up with the home visit service? And my concerns were alleviated through that conversation. Granted, it was just one example, but I sat through the whole home visit, and it was extremely well done and professional and private, with the exception of me being there, which they had agreed to. But it was not invasive from the way the mother described that she had gotten hooked up with the home visits, which was through Nextdoor, that has the contract for the Mid-Columbia. And so anyway, I don't know if you'd have a chance to go on a home visit like that, but it was really enlightening for me.
Thank you. Any questions on that end of the ice? Wow. All right. Thank you. Iris.
Thank you. So, Megan, yes. I guess maybe either you can do the screens when you get to
one. I'm happy to do whatever will work for you.
Bless you.
What do you prefer, Isla?
It's fine.
I'll click your quick.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Gelser, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair Reardon, members of the committee. My name is Iris Bell, and I'm the Director of the Youth Development Council. When last I was before you, I was presenting to you a community engagement investment strategy for how we would actually distribute and allocate funding to communities around the state. That particular strategy had four grant streams in it. There was a youth and community grant, a youth and innovations grant, a youth and gangs grant, and a youth and crime prevention grant. I'm here today to give you an update on what we have done since the distribution of our application process and sending out and doing our procurement process and actually awarding grants into communities. So with that, I was going to take you through. You each have a copy of this slide presentation, and I'll sort of take you through what we were able to do. In our youth and community grant, we had about 108 applications from all three tiers. That was the three-tiered grant, if you recall. We awarded 70 grants. We had an application request of about $8.3 million. You'll note as we move through this that we actually funded about $2 million. So the need far exceeded the amounts of funds that we had available to actually distribute and give out in communities. So we had applications from cities, from counties, and from tribes. We had some that were regional in scope, so that folks came together and applied collectively through the process. Moving on, if you see this page, there's a light sort of green sort of shade on this, and you will see that what is shaded in green is what we were able to fund. At some point, if you look over to the side, you'll see that 2.6, I think, 2.1 or so million dollars there. That's where the cutoff came. That's where our funds for this particular first-tier grant actually ran out. And so we've been working with and developing with those folks in that Tier 1 grant their inputs, their outputs, and their long and short-term outcomes, ensuring that we have outcome measures for the grants that we did award. If you take a look at where those then, oh, great, it comes out. I used to have to describe the outline of the state to people in this one. But this is kind of where that those grants were actually issued with respect to being around the state. And then you'll have your Tier 2 grants. You'll see that we were able, with the funding that we had for Tier 2 grants, to grant funding to every organization that requested funds under that particular grant. And I think the same is clear, is true of tier 3. So all of those particular requests were met. With our Youth and Innovation grant, we had about 27 applications. We had a request of about $2.4 million, again, cities, counties, tribes, and regional requests from those particular entities. And you'll see here where, in awarding the grants, you'll see again where we had to draw the line and stop the funding based on the fact that we had limited funds for our Youth and Innovation grant. And then the next slide will show you where those particular grants went around the state. Then moving quite along, you'll see then we had our Youth and Gangs grant. Here we had, again, the ability to fund all of these grants. We had six applications for funding. You know, I had mentioned previously how we had been working with specific communities around Youth and Gangs around the state. And so this was an area where we kind of understood and knew that they would be using the federal gangs model and they would be coming to us asking for additional funds. And so this is where we made those investments. And you'll probably see the, there they are. You'll see the ones that we did fund. And you'll see a few dots around that one as well. And then we had our youth and crime prevention grants. And here, this was a very, very small grant. And let me tell you a little bit about why that is. These are federal dollars. And over the years, the federal dollars have begun to shrink and shrink and shrink and shrink. And so our youth and crime prevention grants that are federally funded have gone from, I think, years ago, maybe about 20 years ago, when we were Commission on Children and Families, we had about $20 million coming from the feds for some of this work. And just over the years, it has continued to dwindle and go down. And it has, for us, some concern because if we begin to be too federally funded, you know, it sort of impacts us when the feds start to cut back on those dollars. And so that then is the overall sort of picture. You'll see where we made those crests, and you'll see again the little dots. And then I think your last page kind of shows you this application reviewers piece. This was our attempt to be very transparent about where folks came from, who actually reviewed all of these grants and read through them and scored them and made the recommendations to the council, Youth Development Council, with respect to what we funded. We just finished that whole process of talking about the inputs, the outputs, and the outcomes with all of these different groups. And so we have those now in place, and we will begin taking a look at how they do and offering technical assistance to them as we move through the rest of the year. We are also in the process of beginning to start our biennial funding cycle. So we will be gearing up to have applications out for the 15-17 biennium that would have these applications in place going July 1 of 2015. So with that, any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So as I looked through these maps, rather briefly, certainly there's a trend, the metro area, I-5 corridor. And I understand there's lots of pieces to that. And to be fair, I see on here that one of my school districts received a pretty decent grant, a little under $100,000. and one of the chairs, or the chair, yeah, the chair school district, and I'm seeing different ones of, scattered. But what I look at here is, so overview of applications, this particular one, 108 applications across all tiers of funding. So there were 108 applications received, and then 70 were awarded. Would that be correct? So we know the struggle, and the struggle is small rural parts of Oregon being able to compete, or having the infrastructure, or having the staff, or the having the whatever. How can we help that? Because the next set of maps, I would like to see those dots scattered a little bit more. And I got to tell you, $20,000 in a small community is just as valuable as $200,000 in Portland. So how can we scatter that? And what's being done to do that?
Chair Gelser, Representative Springer. One of the things that we did do as a result of these this application process is reach out to those individuals, particularly in some of the rural and smaller counties, that did not apply, to ask why. In fact, there's a survey that we did to say, you know, we were expecting, as we had engaged you in some conversation, an application from you, what happened. Many of them had elected to wait for the 15-17 year. In other words, the year that we just distributed money for was just that one single year. In fact, almost less than about 10 months or so. So many of them said, we would prefer to wait. So we had a number who preferred to wait. We had another number who felt that they should take a look more at that collective impact model to see whether or not they could meet the requirements of a collective impact methodology, which in which we said we will offer you technical assistance for that piece. So there were many different reasons why, as we sort of heard from communities, they did not apply. But our response has been to them that we would be willing to offer technical assistance, to encourage them to apply, to come out to their communities, to work with them, to work with their school districts, to ensure that we get a larger number across the state applying, particularly since we're going into a 15-17 biennial application process.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions?
See, you did such a good job. We used all our questions on the first panel.
Thank you all very, very much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah. That's
fair.
All right, so we are going to close the information hearing on the Early Learning and Youth Development Division's update, and we are going to open an information session on the Student Data Privacy Work Group update, and we've got Representative Lou Frederick and Peter Tromba. And we have, we need to finish this item by about 4:05. Are we?
We're trying to do it earlier.
Wow.
Try. I said try.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Lou Frederick, State Representative from District 43. That's North and Northeast Portland. And I am pleased to be here. Thank you very much for inviting us to give this presentation. This will be a relatively brief presentation, but you've heard some of these things before. We spoke last in the 2014 session about the concerns that a number of people had about the student records privacy and who had access to the records of students, who could change them, what kind of records were there, were they discipline records as well as academic. How long were they available to people? And so we began a process of trying to find a way to answer some of those questions. And we did not get a bill out during the 2014 session, but frankly, I think we actually got it maybe better. We actually put together a work group that was really an extraordinary work group. And I'm very pleased. Peter Tromba and his team at OEIB did an excellent job, not just in terms of organizing the work, but also in doing the research. Every day, literally every day, there is an article somewhere, New York Times, Dallas, Texas, California, on this issue. And they managed to bring together some of those particular articles and do a great job on researching what was going on. We had three meetings, I think that's right, three meetings. We had probably the last meeting, we had about 30 people there. We had industry, and we had four students from McCary there, as well as parents and teachers and administrators and all sorts of folks. It was a very good work group. As a result, I'm going to let Peter talk a little bit about the work group, and then I have a couple of things I wanted to bring to you as some of the proposals I'll be putting forward. So.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Senator Gelzer, members of the committee. Peter Tromba, for the record, the Policy and Research Director from the Oregon Education Investment Board. We did have three meetings of our student data privacy work group, and from the beginning, we were looking at three different areas. It's a pretty complex topic. One of those is data privacy. One is data use, and the third has to do with auditing, security, breaches, and consequences, sort of a catch-all. And I want to outline something I'm sure the committee is aware of, but I think it bears repeating, that the laws that are currently on the books in Oregon, as well as the administrative rules that are on the books in Oregon, were written at a time that folks probably couldn't imagine the kind of tools that exist today in terms of either getting to student data or using it for ill purposes. And therefore, we have a great deal of resonance among many different members of this work group from lots of different places with lots of different perspectives that now's a good time to check in on the laws and rules that we have in our state to make sure that we shore up areas that need that. With respect to data privacy, really the group looked at commercial use of data as being a key issue. It's very easy now for student data to be leaked in a way from a small local school district or in some fashion to a commercial provider and for it to all of a sudden spread to be used for all kinds of different things. So as you'll see as we conclude this work and look towards legislative concepts, there's a number of things that have come up, not just in Oregon, but across the country around privacy, and especially with regard to commercial use. With respect to using data, I think I can say we've got some differences of opinion on the work group. There are folks who do jobs like I do, who are public servants, who are looking to have data to make the best decisions possible in terms of our budget and looking at our outcomes. Then there's other folks who say that it's unacceptable. There's no acceptable reason that we would want to be using personal student data, no matter how good the benefit might be to the state. So I think there's a real, in my eyes, there's a balance there, but I would judge it one way, and I think others would judge it other ways with respect to the use. And then finally, with respect to audits or breaches or consequences, one very disquieting thing that we learned as a work group is that we already have a lot of great laws on the books about data privacy, from the federal government to the state and to local, not only in education, but also through Department of Administrative Services and other places. And although we have these laws on the books, there are very few consequences to breaking those laws. So literally, very sacred laws about student data privacy that when you're trained to be a school administrator like I was, you think you have to follow them no matter what. What we learned about is in many cases that even when those laws are broken, there's no consequence whatsoever, which was an upsetting topic, and I think something that's going to be addressed as we move forward. We did have three meetings. By the final meeting, we did have a large group of folks that were at the meeting, lots of public testimony, and it was great to see the participation of so many Oregon citizens. I'd like to conclude just that quick review and then have questions, but I'd like to let you know that on the OEIB website, which is education.oregon.gov, there's a report that one of the members of our staff did all about data privacy, and I recommend it highly. It's hundreds of pages long, but it's something that you can sample and look to find certain things within it that are germane to what you're looking for. And included in that report is data not just on Oregon and how we're doing with our laws and rules, but how many, many other states are doing. So if you're looking for comparator states, or if you're wondering how the new legislation just passed in California relates to some of the issues that we're coming up with, it's a great report to start with. And not only is it a great report, but its bibliography is phenomenal. So if you want to go deeper, it's all right there, a click away to go deeper into it. I think that's it. Just another thank you to the committee members who spent a lot of their time giving us their best thinking on this, and then I'll turn over to Rep. Frederick.
Thank you very much. And let me finish. Do I need to reintroduce myself?
No, we remember you.
That's fine. well, having looked at that, one of the key, I have six LCs that I've drafted. The main one is 2457, and I'll be getting that around to you to look at. It is not that difficult to explain because it is simply taking a look at the California law on privacy, student privacy, and we're adopting it. I will read one section of it that I think is important. It talks about the kinds of records that are important to figure out how we're going to deal with. Student discipline records, test results, special education data, juvenile dependency records, grades, evaluations, criminal records, medical records, health records, social security number, biometric information, disability, socioeconomic information, food purchases, political affiliations, religious information, text messages, documents, student identifiers, search activities, photos, voice recordings, or geolocation information. All of those things are part of that, are mentioned within the California legislation because all of those things are, in fact, collected in some form for students. And we need to figure out how we are going to, in fact, handle those particular issues. There's the California law passed and is in place right now, was signed by the governor, and it is something that's being used as a jumping-off point for a lot of other states, and I think we should be taking a good close look at it. That's just one of the bills. We have bills. I have a LC dealing with the right to view student records, identity theft, the sanctions, as Peter mentioned earlier, the privacy risk, and there are bills related to other standardized testing and information protection. The idea is a very simple one. You should know what kind of information is being collected on you, if it's correct information, who it's going to, and why, and for how long. That's one of the issues that I run into. I always mention this because it's always appropriate. I know all of us were perfect when we were in seventh grade. I know I was. There was a halo over me at that time. There still is. That's a halo. Really? That is. Being held up by the horns. I understand. But the fact is, I know that we have if you have that kind of a record of things going on at seventh grade, and that is passed along when you decide to apply to University of Oregon or Oregon State. I don't want to get in trouble with anybody here, or PSU. Earlham wouldn't get there. That's not a state school. Okay, so, yeah, Earlham would be appropriate. With Earlham, yeah, sorry, we're going back into our alumni routine here. that would be available for any admissions person. And what kind of information, whether it's correct or not, is another thing. Never mind the correctness of a discipline, but let's just say, perhaps, that the testing that we're doing now is not necessarily really effective. It doesn't tell us very much, but it's now part of your record as well, and that people are making decisions based on that. How do you adjust for that? We don't have a way of doing that right now. And added to that, I will say that there are some other questions that I think are important as well. We do need a way to evaluate how well students are doing. Everyone wants that. But who has access to that record and what they can do with it is a question. And so that's what we're working on.
Thank you very much. Questions? Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just curious, did Becky Strauss work with the work group?
Sitting two people away from me. She was there as well. Absolutely.
Any further questions? Representative Reardon.
Actually, just a quick question I could have asked Deputy Superintendent as well, but is there like one computer system that collects and records all of this information, or?
That's an interesting question, because we're talking about a database that the OEIB is talking about. What is it called? I'm trying to
longitudinal
database. These are the kinds of data. That's the kind of database that, in fact, might be available. And what does that mean? How do we use that? How do we evaluate how folks are doing and who has control of that?
And I'm glad you're bringing it up because I had those same questions earlier. I didn't ask them, but, you know, we're keeping a lot of information about students' achievement and so forth, and we just have to have a good tool for educators to use so they can do their job and something that's not a great burden on them and yet, as you bring up, protect the rights of the students. So.
Representative Reardon, as a result, part of the other discussion what we had was, in fact, we have a number of people who are putting together the connections between the educational issues and Department of Human Services, the housing issues, employment. All of these things, how do they connect, and who has control of that? How is that? How do you avoid privacy breaches within that kind of situation?
Well, and I'm thinking of how to use it to provide a better service.
Yes.
As well, if I have a kid that transfers from Centennial to David Douglas, it shouldn't take 6 weeks to get the information.
Absolutely.
How do we do that? Well, so anyway.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. We did it. See?
You did. You. Excellent work. Thank you very much. And with that, we're going to close the information session on Student Data Privacy Workgroup Update and open an information session called Oregon's Education Fundamentals Gap. So Craig and Chuck, and I believe we have the superintendent of Umatilla County here too.
Last information session.
Last information session of the day. Welcome, and thanks for making the drive.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Craig Hawkins, Executive Director of COSA. And with me are Heidi Seip, Superintendent of Umatilla School District, and the current president of our Superintendents Association. And of course, Chuck Bennett from COSA as well. This summer and throughout the fall, we've been engaged in a number of conversations around the state with superintendents, and the basic fundamental part of the conversation is around how can we improve outcomes for all students, and then, you know, what investment or practices do we need to engage in order to achieve that? And the conversation actually started at our superintendent's vision group meeting this summer. And it was a little bit different meeting than it's been in the past because for the first time, superintendents in that room walked in to that conversation not having cut their budgets in the previous spring. And so Heidi had an interesting perception.
And if you wouldn't mind your full name for the record, please.
Thanks. Representative Gelser, members of the committee, thank you. Heidi Seip from Umatilla. And I've been in Umatilla and superintendent in Umatilla since 2007, and this last spring was the first time in my tenure as a superintendent to not either absorb positions or cut staff, and in many years both. And so I really recognize the work that went into making that happen and appreciate it. But I also believe that it gave us a unique opportunity this last summer because for a long time we've been in nothing but survival mode, really a true crisis triage situation. And so that was the first opportunity that we were able to sit down and talk as visionary leaders instead of as responders.
So we began to ask ourselves this summer, really, why does it seem like we've just sort of accepted that Oregon has one of the shortest school years in the nation? You know, and what's the cumulative effect of that short school year? We asked ourselves, if we were going to add instructional time to a school year, what are the most effective ways to do that, and how do we go about it in a way that makes sure that we improve outcomes for each and every student? And at the same time, as we begin to investigate instructional time and where we stand in Oregon, we begin to talk about things like, well, you know, we've also got a challenge of having some of the largest class sizes in the nation, and then we have the challenges of actually having at best incomplete programs and services in many areas for students, and how do we take all of that into account and talk about it? And we began to call that Oregon's Education Fundamentals Gap, just as a shorthand for us to begin to talk about it. And so for us, it includes these three foundational elements: instructional time, class size, and funding to provide basic programs and supports. So when you compare instructional time, and that's where we're going to start, it's a little bit like comparing various kinds of apples. It's apple to apple, but it's, you know, Granny Smith to Macintosh. And for some of the reasons listed here, one is that rules about instructional time differ from state to state. In fact, some states do it entirely by days. Others do it by hours. And also, many schools and districts around the country choose to exceed the minimum required number of hours, including many in Oregon. But we think that by kind of taking this look at a national level, you kind of smooth out some of those variations and get a good average look. The last thing is that we did not use information related to furlough days or cut school days over the last several years, or the difference between half-day and full-day kindergarten. We wanted to look at purely grades 1 through 12. Had we used those things, of course, the information would have looked worse. So if you take a look comparing minimum instructional time in Oregon compared to the national average, to the nation, when you take a look at what students receive grades 1 to 12 in terms of instructional hours in Oregon, again based on minimum standards, and compared to the national average, we're about a year short. So by the time a student completes 12th grade, he or her has had about a year less of instructional time in an Oregon school than the national average.
Where this really hit home for me is my son is a senior this year, and we intentionally moved to Oregon from Washington when my children were 1 and 3 because we really believed that Oregon had a superior system and we wanted to be a part of it. And so now as my son is graduating this year and heading off to college, we're forced looking at each other, trying to figure out if we made the right call. Because as he walks into college this fall, he has one entire school year less in his educational tool belt than the students with whom he's competing. And so as a parent, this type of data is concerning. As an educator, I really hope that we can correct this. Hopefully today I have a nephew being born in Oregon, and I really hope that by the time he's in kindergarten, we're no longer having this conversation.
We also looked at this in terms of the early literacy effort that we all believe in, the K-3 reading effort. And so if you look at, this is for grades 1 to 3. Again, we didn't include kindergarten. We're about a third of a year in, again, comparing minimum instructional hours, short by the end of grade 3, a trimester short, than compared to the average of students in other states. And then finally, since this is the year where we implement Smarter Balanced, we thought it was really interesting to take a look at Smarter Balanced states that have instructional time, do instructional time the same way Oregon does. And you can see that we're tied for at the bottom in terms of instructional time for students grades 1 through 11. Again, almost a year behind the national average. In fact, really what it amounts to is that while students are supposed to be take the assessment in the late spring of their junior years, when you compare instructional time, in many cases in Oregon, students are taking it in effect at the beginning of their junior year. So part of the reason that we focused on instructional time is there's really good research out there supporting the importance of instructional time, especially for students who really need that time, you know, special education, ELL, and other students who simply need more time to hit the high expectations we have for all kids. But of course, that's just one of the three education fundamentals. Another is class size. We thought you'd be interested to know that we're 49th in student-teacher ratio in the country. And on a per-teacher basis, that's 6 more kids in every classroom than the national average. And, of course, funding is all part of this. You can see that Oregon spends about 88% of the national average per pupil, and it's really disheartening, but it goes back to what Representative Gelser said earlier about the move from the Measure 5 era as we've gone through. We were at 104% in 1997-98, so there's been a significant decline compared to the nation, and that we're 46th in state tax expenditures on K-12 as a percent of state taxable resources.
Can I? Yes.
two questions on that. On your student-teacher ratio, is that student to actual classroom teacher, or is that student to, you know, kind of the whole picture of adults in the building? Because we have a lot of, you know, administrative folks in that mix, and so I'm curious how they're factored in and then compared to other states. And on the 46 for state expenditures, that does not include then, you know, if I'm assuming that when I say state, when I see state taxable resources, that doesn't include local options and local property tax, or does that, is that all wrapped in there?
Representative Gelser, Representative Parrish, I will double check. I'll tell you what I believe, but I'll make sure.
Okay.
In terms of the latter one, I believe it includes all taxable resources in a state. But I'll double check that and let you know. In terms of the student teacher ratio, it's licensed teachers, not, doesn't include administrators or anything else, but it's a teacher to student ratio. So it would include, for example, a counselor or a librarian, I believe.
Thanks.
So one other thing that we did is we Chuck and Heidi and I had meetings with superintendents and other administrators all around the state, Baker City, Coos Bay, you almost name a community, and we were there. And what we asked them was, with the current base level of funding, what are the most common basic programs and services that you're not able to provide? And we weren't looking for the extra special, but really, truly basic. And you can see this list here. Nothing got on this list unless it came up multiple times. I'll point you to just a couple. The counselor, elementary counselors, social workers, et cetera, came up especially in our more rural settings. That was a huge need. It's a huge need everywhere. It came up everywhere, but it really came up strongly there. And then, of course, electives, including music and art, STEM and CTE programs, et cetera, et cetera. There's a long list. And then we looked at all of this stuff and said, if we're going to compare ourselves, if we're going to do a little bit of comparative work, what should we do here? And so we took the Quality Counts report, which ranks student achievement among states based on a number of factors, but it's student scores on the national, the NAEP test, it's effectiveness in closing achievement gaps, and a variety of other pieces. And it ranked states, and you can see Oregon ranked 40th. But we thought we'd compare ourselves to the top five and just say that, you know, we aspire to be as strong as an education system as there can be any place. So we thought we'd take a look. And so we compared the top five to us in terms of minimum instructional hours, grades 1 to 12. And you can see that the three states that do it, you know, compare hours or have standards that are hours-based like we do, have significantly more hours. You can see the class size ranks, and you can see students per teacher. We have at least 7 more than any of the top five. We thought we'd also compare rank in terms of funding and per pupil spending, and again you can see that those ranks pretty much line up with the student achievement ranks and other pieces. And we thought we'd share these. You've probably seen these before, but these are the share of the budget that's gone to education, and this is both total education and K-12 since 2003-05. Decline until the current biennium, where we had a slight uptick that Heidi mentioned is very much appreciated. And then the percentage of state, the state budget, and where it's gone over that same period of time. And finally, as we had the conversations with superintendents around the state, we began to come together on a real basic approach and a way of thinking about funding and what we'd like to accomplish in the next biennium. And that was first that we need an adequate level of base funding that allows districts to maintain current programs and the current service levels that we provide. Second, that we really believe in implementing full-day kindergarten. We need the funding to do that. And then third, and very important to us as well, is the highest priority from a conversation around what else would you invest in? If you could do it beyond maintaining programs and adding full-day kindergarten, what would be the next investment, especially as it's related to instructional time, because that was a big focus of our conversation. And what superintendents around the state reached a really quick and solid consensus around was investing in instructional times and other programs, time and other programs and services for students who need them most. So not really dissimilar from the goals of the governor, the OEIB. Very much they would fit in the same, very much along the same lines. The difference, of course, is the mechanism that we would use to get there.
Representative members of the committee, I know that this data is sobering, and that was the experience that we all had this summer and throughout the fall as we've worked on it. And one of the activities we did early on was we asked people to please stand up if they had a number of services in their schools when they went to school, especially if they were students in Oregon. And it was everything from librarians, nurses, counselors. You know, did we have those services as children? And the answer was yes. And then we asked those people to keep standing if they continued to offer those services in their schools, and unfortunately there was no one left standing in the room by the time we finished the activity. And so my hope is that we can start working toward improving our trajectory and getting Oregon back on track to become the premier system that we all seek for it to be. We know our students deserve more, and we're just asking that we help get them more.
Great. And thank I'm just you. Along for the ride.
Thank you. Well, before I open up for other questions, I just wanted to tag back to the earlier presentation. You were all here. If you look at the proposed budget and all of the resources that are in K-12, how much of an increase is that for districts? And if all of that went to buying more school days, how many additional school days or hours would we be able to purchase with the increased investment?
Representative Gelser, members of the committee, I'm afraid I can only speak for my own district, but the budget that was presented to you earlier is a cuts budget for my district, and a significant cuts budget at that. So instead of buying back days, that's a budget proposal that allows me to, forces me to have the conversation of once again cutting days.
And would you be making reductions even before shifting things for the formula shift?
Oh,
is that prior to the formula shift, or is that because of the formula shift?
No, my district is actually one of the districts who would be a winner, if you will, under the formula shift. However, on the funding task force, I was one of the members who voted against it, and not at all because I believe that we do not need more funds for ELL students. I wholeheartedly believe we need to do more for our ELL students, our students of color, and our students of poverty. However, I concur with the funding task force recommendation, which is this is a huge decision. We need further study to get it right, and we need to look at not only ELL students but students of poverty, and we need to make sure that we're making a very careful, calculated decision before we recommend changing anything. To just simply go from 0.5 to 0.6 gets my district more money, but it also gets it at the expense of other students in the state because there was not additional money added to the formula to do that. And when we look at students of color, unfortunately, roughly 50% of our students of color in Oregon would be losing funding for themselves because their districts would lose funding under that proposal. That's not a solution I can stand behind.
Maybe Representative Gelser, members of the committee, maybe a little bit more information about that. The at our early analysis, that's actually we did in partnership with the Oregon Association of School Business Officials, says that year to year, from this year to next year, when you include the additional FTE for kindergarten students, where it's nearly a $200 per student reduction as proposed by the governor. So it's significant cuts budget for everybody, or essentially everybody, and so that doesn't leave additional dollars to take forward.
Other questions? Representative Reardon.
Same question I asked earlier, but I still don't think I understood the answer. So could you guys give me, because this sounds suspiciously like my East County, East Multnomah County superintendents meeting I went to last week, but could you give me what you think the base number is from last biennium, add 200 million or whatever for kindergarten, and then what the new base should be, so I know what the real base is, so that, you know, just all I want to know, just for my own frame of mind, is what's the reference point? And there's just so much hand waving that seems to go on with all of this. So do you know that by now, by any chance?
We do. Representative Gelser, Representative Reardon, part of the conversations we had with superintendents all fall, asked the very question of, simply to roll up existing programs, to continue to offer the same services and programs you're offering this year in the next biennium. How much do you need? And including $220 million for full-day kindergarten, that answer is $7.5 billion. Yeah. That is the median and the applies to the vast majority. There will be some districts that can do it for less, others who will still cut at that level. But $7.5 billion is absolutely the answer. And then I will tell you that if you were asking us for our number, we would tell you it's $7.85 billion because we think we need a $350 million investment in programs and services, instructional time, et cetera, for students who really need those investments.
We also, Madam Chair, Chuck Bennett with COSA, we also would suggest that as policy committees and budget committees begin moving forward, rather than looking at the, and I thought your comments, all of your comments on this were very interesting. It's one we've been sharing as well, is what a heavy lift it is to try to deal with the state school fund and try to use a distribution formula as a spending formula, and have recommended to the governor that they look very, very seriously at the old school improvement fund as the mechanism for moving funds around, that it deals with it allows you to set up targeted programs, set up some sideboards, but it distributes the money through the school distribution formula rather than trying to jigger the formula toward some sort of outcome. And we actually, it's this governor that really started the school improvement fund, and one of the real outstanding uses of it when it was in effect for the 1 year it lasted before the recession began and it was cut was for third grade literacy, and actually showed some real successes, but it lasted 1 year and went away. What we need along with this, Madam Chair, is a real commitment by the legislature and the governor to some sort of sustainable growth in this budget. This cyclical ups, downs, you know, it's a cut this year, it's up next year, that kind of thing, or if you're going to add programs, that there at least be some sustainable funding source or plan behind it. And I know that's asking. I've been around long enough to know what I'm asking for, and I understand it, you know, but some of us dream as we get older in life.
So, Chuck, just as a follow-up to Representative Reardon's question about the number, and you said 7.5. There's every time we talk about a state school funding number, people have different ways of saying, well, it's 7, but it's really 6. What is the number that you believe the proposed budget is? Is it 6.9? Is it 7.2? Is it 8? What?
It's
compared to the 7.5, if you measure it with those assumptions, what? Just so we're comparing apples and apples.
6.914.
Yeah. We're not sure where 7.2 would come from, or 7.9, or any other number we heard earlier. We just weren't sure where those would come from. 6.914 is the state school fund. And then if you subtract 220 from it, remember 220 is the additional half day of kindergarten. You take it down then, $220 million, and you really see what actually is being added to the base of what we had last time, and it's about $44 million, which is pretty, well, I don't know, from my perspective, somewhat jaw-dropping. That number is way too low to really begin to put the program back together for another 2 years.
Representative Gomberg.
Thank you, Chair Gelser. And I want to thank the panel for bringing us what you described as sobering information. I think the committee here has probably grown weary of me over the last 2 years. Every time we get some study showing us lagging behind another state, I pull up very quickly the number of teaching days they're offering, compare them to ours, and ask if maybe that's why we've got a difference. That being said, I had a question for you. You've suggested to us that we invest in programs and services for the kids who need the most. And I wanted to ask you, who are the kids that need the most? Are we talking about kids that are lagging behind in reading, kids with language skills? Are we talking about talented and gifted, special needs? Or maybe I should ask, who are the kids that don't need our help right now?
Representative Gels. I'm sorry, Gelser. Representative Gomberg, members of the committee. Perhaps the easiest way to describe who are the students who need it most are not by looking solely at demographics, but actually look at individual student performance. And one of the real benefits of a system such as Chuck recommended with the Old School Improvement Fund is that that allows districts to say, here's our innovation money, what are our student needs, and where should we best invest these funds to ensure that our students are succeeding. My own district, I can tell you that we had some of the lowest KRA or kindergarten assessment data in the state. And so last year, we wrote some grants and teamed up and did what we could to get preschool going for our students that could not afford it. And keep in mind that Umatilla serves about 70% minority population and the poorest student population in the state of Oregon year after year. So we have a lot of student needs. So if I were to say that the funds should go to students of poverty and the funds should go to ELL students, yes, that's typically true. But I also have a lot of non-ELL, non-poverty students. Well, I don't have very many non-poverty students, actually, but I have a lot of students that may not fit one of those categories who may also need additional support. So I think we need to perhaps consider demographics as a way to distribute funds. But once those funds are received, we really need to look at individual student performance and set our goals, set lofty goals, because all kids can and should succeed in our system, and do what we can to make sure that's a reality.
Thank you. Any further questions for this panel? Thank you very much. That was a very sobering and informational presentation. So with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on Oregon's Education Fundamentals Gap. I do not believe we have any committee bills for introduction, unless somebody has a surprise. No? All right. And then I just wanted to take a minute to thank all of you. It's been my pleasure to be part of this committee for the last 6 years.
You going somewhere?
Going somewhere. I'm going to miss it a lot. This committee was the single hardest thing when I was making my decision about whether or not to move on. It's been a real pleasure to serve with each of you. I think education is something that everyone's passionate about. And if you were to quiz members of the legislature about why they ran, for many of us, it has to do with public education. I think the conversations that we had today about the goals that we all share and how do we get there with the limited resources that we have is going to continue to be a struggle and a challenge for all of us. It's always been great for me to get to sit on this committee and see all of the work and the thought and the people that are working on making things even better for our kids, and then to go back home and see how well cared for my kids are in our public schools every day. And I look at these numbers and know that that's a measure of how we need to do better. But then I go back and I look at the kids in my district, and I'm just really proud of what our teachers and our students and our classified staff and administrators and volunteers are really able to put together for our kids every day. We have so very much to be proud of, and I've gotten to learn a lot more about that sitting here. So thank you all very much, and I hope
members have come and gone from this committee, but do you know, I mean, this is a quick quiz. Do you know which member you have served longest with on this committee?
That would be Representative Huffman, who I have been with every term.
And I apologize for
that. We've been co-chairs together. You've been vice chair. We've done all kinds of things together, and I've appreciated that friendship and support. And Representative Springer, even if you did put a cougar in my backyard a few weeks ago, I am just really grateful for the partnership and the friendship that we've gotten to work on here for the last few years. Thank you all very much, and we are adjourned.